Today at Reader's Corner, Steve Inskeep, author of the new book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. I'm Bob Custrell. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Throughout his life and political career, Lincoln often agreed to disagree. Democracy demanded it, since even an adversary had a vote. In his latest book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America, Steve Inskeep illuminates Lincoln's life through 16 encounters, some well-known, some obscure, but each marked by an ability to engage with critics and enemies. The result is a nuanced portrait of a politician who held strong to his moral compass while navigating corrosive political factions and uniting a divided nation. Steve Inskeep is a co-host of NPR's Morning Edition, the most widely heard radio program in the United States, and of NPR's Up First, one of the nation's most popular podcasts. A dedicated journalist who's traveled the globe for the story, he is the author of Instant City, Jackson Land, and Imperfect Union. Steve Inskeep, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you. Appreciate that introduction.
Well, it's nice to have you back in Boise, I guess we could say, since you were here in January and we all enjoyed your presentation. I have to comment at the beginning to the 16, and I think this is so important for readers. I spent many years of my life in Springfield, Illinois. I've toured President Lincoln's home more than I can count. I think I could probably do New Salem blindfolded. And yet I'm reading your book and realizing that I am meeting for the first time most of the people you have chosen for these brief biographies. And I think that's what's so revelatory about your book, that I felt like I'm learning something new. I'm learning a new angle to the challenges Lincoln faced. That's so important, especially for anyone listening who feels like, well, I read three Lincoln biographies, so I don't need to read this one. I'm going to guarantee them they're going to read something new here. So thanks for that, Steve.
Thank you. I'm delighted to hear you say that. I felt the same way about researching this. I met some of these characters for the first time, met in the sense of learning about them in the research while I was writing the book. Mary Ellen Wise, a woman who put on a man's army uniform and said she went to war and then asked Abraham Lincoln for her back pay. That's a person I'd never heard of. Joseph Gillespie, a friend of Lincoln's, who was a kind of nativist, anti-immigrant guy, but Lincoln managed to make him a political ally too. That's someone I never heard of. Yeah. And there are people like that sprinkled all through the more famous characters, somebody like William Henry Seward, his Secretary of State. There's a chapter about Seward, a chapter about George McClellan. So I feel that I've mixed a few greatest hits in with what you might call the album cuts. These are characters that are entirely new to me as well. And even in cases, there's some of these, Bob, where I'd heard of the guy. Thurlow Weed, this political operator from Lincoln's time, was a name that I'd heard, but I hadn't thought deeply about him until I encountered him and his backstory for one of the chapters of this book.
Yeah, and that's one of the few I did know for a different reason. About a year ago, I guess, maybe not that long, we interviewed Edward Acorn, who wrote the book, The Lincoln Miracle, which is the story of how Lincoln captured the Republican nomination in 1860. And Seward, of course, is all over the thing. But if Seward's over it, then you know Thurlow Weed will be. But we're going to hold off on that for a minute because I want to get to that. I actually have you a question about that. Let's begin with the basics. The title of the book, it's based on how Lincoln handled disagreements with his friends. Tell us about, I think it was Joshua Speed.
Yeah, Joshua Speed, the best friend of his life, who was, like Lincoln, from Kentucky, and unlike Lincoln, grew up in a slaveholding family, a family that profited from slavery. Joshua grew up rich in this big house on a farm where they grew hemp and other crops outside of Louisville, Kentucky, then moved to the free state of Illinois, which is where he met Abraham Lincoln a little bit later on in life. And Lincoln befriended him despite their difference in backgrounds, and in 1855 wrote his best friend a letter saying, "I'm glad that you now agree in the abstract that slavery is wrong, but you are still politically wrong as to how to go about attacking it. You are mistaken. So he's telling Joshua Speed he's wrong on a really important moral issue, and then adds, but if for this we must differ, differ we must. And he signs the letter, your friend forever. And this is really significant to me because we are often told when you disagree with someone, especially on an important issue, that it may be that you need to separate yourself from them, to ostracize them. You should not listen to them. You should not let them speak either. You should not let them, you should not give them a platform. You should not let them spread their whatever you want to say. Lincoln had a different approach. He was very clear as to why he thought his friend was wrong, but he kept close to that guy, kept working on him. And this is an important part of the story. Eventually got some political use out of Joshua Speed, who was on Lincoln's side when the Civil War came.
So I may have the name confused, but was Joshua Speed also the guy who Lincoln was on the riverboat with where he met the fiddler?
Oh, you are exactly right. Should I tell that story?
Oh, yeah. I think that's so important to how Lincoln evolves through this trip to anti-slavery.
Yeah, he went with his best friend to the house, the farm, the plantation, if you will, in Kentucky. They use the word farm there, but it was, you know, there's 50-some enslaved people working this farm. And Lincoln went for a visit with his friend. And then they returned by steamboat, going down the Ohio River and back up the Mississippi River and then overland, most likely, to Springfield, Illinois. And on this multi-day steamboat journey on the Ohio River, Lincoln was sharing the deck with his friend and with a dozen men who were chained together, who were being sold down the river, as it was sometimes put then. They were being sold out of Kentucky, where the economy was changing, and sold farther south to the Deep South, where the labor was most likely going to be much harder and conditions much harsher, and they were more likely to be worked to death. They were sold from one slavery to an even worse corner of slavery. And Lincoln spent time apparently talking with these men, learning their stories. One of the men on deck was a fiddler. He had a fiddle. He was playing songs. He was cracking jokes. The other men were singing. But this man had been separated from his wife to be sold away from everything he had ever known. And that was a troubling image that stayed with Lincoln for years, which we know because he wrote about it immediately at the time. It's the only detailed account he ever left of an encounter with enslaved people. And then 14 years later, wrote Joshua Speed another letter. And he says, how can you say I have no interest in slavery when it has such capacity to make me miserable? He is claiming that he has a voice in the issue of slavery, which slave owners kept saying, this isn't any of your business. It's between us and our state and our slaves, basically. And Lincoln was saying, no, as someone from the North, as a citizen, as a human being, I have a voice here. I have something to say.
We tend to look at Lincoln's life and his career, his history, which it is, of course. And I'm sure there are people out there who don't see how it could possibly be applicable to our crisis of the moment, although I can't imagine there's many of them, but that's another story. There was significant change underway in America. And you note in your first chapter or so, just what was going on in America at that time that makes a little more liking to what we're going through.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to draw the parallels too closely because I don't think the parallels are that close, but it was a divided nation. It was divided North and South. The fundamental divide was over slavery, which was a huge one because it wrapped in race and the economy and wealth and people's identities and their idea of themselves and the whole organization of society. Northern states had gradually abolished slavery by the middle of the 19th century. Southern states were ever more fervently embracing it. It became a larger and larger factor in their economy, and it was also described by pro-slavery ideologues as the foundation of society. There had been a time when Southerners acknowledged that slavery was a bad thing, and they said it was an evil that we inherited from our ancestors, and it ought to go away someday. But by the mid-1800s, there were people affirmatively saying slavery is good, the way that it ought to be, the way that everything and everybody ought to be. And the anti-slavery movement in the North was getting stronger and stronger at a time when communication was getting faster. They didn't have the internet back then, but in the same way that we've had these disorienting changes in technology and communication, they were having disorienting changes in the 1800s because steamboats and then railroads and daily newspapers and the telegraph were effectively shortening the distances between people and giving people an idea of what was happening elsewhere in the country in real time. And it was really hard to deal with that. It was really hard for people to be confronted with stories of what was happening elsewhere in the country at the same time when the nation was so divided. And it became harder and harder to compromise, harder and harder to accommodate this fundamental moral disagreement within the political system. Mm-hmm. And of course, the final break was people in the South losing an election and deciding not to accept the results of a free and fair election and attempting to go off and start their own country.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Steve Inskeep, author of the new book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. Well, Lincoln certainly walked a fine line, and I'm not going to say any more because I'd like you to share this with our readers, but the radical Joshua Giddings, he's an anti-slavery activist. He's a politician who attempts to influence Lincoln. Lincoln chooses a course that is somewhat different than that. And why don't you take it at that? And also, you might point out that misinformation and propaganda was alive and well in those days.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People would describe each other in all different kinds of ways. And there were very partisan news outlets. In fact, most newspapers were associated with one political party or another. Although, let me pause to say, I find them in some ways a reliable source of information because you'd have this Democratic paper and Republican paper. The Democratic paper might say, look how insane and stupid the other side is. We're going to reprint their entire speech so that you can see how foolish they are. And I kind of like that.
Right.
Different than today when someone says, let me show you this 3-second video clip of the other guy falling down, the most embarrassing thing that he did. And you're like, you don't get any context or anything. And the video might be real. It might be fake. You don't know anything. Actually, the newspapers were informative then. But in any case, I mean, that is happening. And then there are divides within the divides. We said anti-slavery, pro-slavery. So that's the big divide. But there are more subtle things going on. Within people who are broadly opposed to slavery, there are many, many, many points of view. Should we be super radical and demand that it end right now? Should we acknowledge that that's constitutionally impossible because there was this unbelievable legal edifice supporting slavery and see if we can do something more limited? What can we do to build a political majority in this country where there are lots of different points of view and lots of people who are basically racist and don't have a lot of sympathy for Black people? What are the different things that we can do? And Lincoln took what I guess you might consider a more moderate course. He wanted to be extremely careful about what he said, and he wanted to acknowledge that there was a constitution, that the law was supreme, and that there were states that practiced slavery where he couldn't do anything about it as a citizen of a free state. What he wanted to do was limit slavery, and that put him in some cases in a different place than other anti-slavery forces, figures who wanted to do something more radical. You mentioned Joshua Giddings. This is one of the guys who brought Lincoln into the anti-slavery cause. Giddings, as a radical member of Congress in the 1840s, made a proposal to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. And he couldn't get it done. He didn't have the votes. But Lincoln came along and offered to try to help him. And Lincoln made a proposal to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. He proposed to do it very, very gradually. It would have taken decades for everybody enslaved in the district to be freed under this proposal. But Lincoln's scheme, his idea, was to get more conservative citizens of Washington, D.C. to go along with this plan. He thought that he had a chance to succeed. In the end, he failed. But I think it is an illustration of Lincoln's political technique. He was trying to build a majority. He always said slavery was fundamentally wrong. He never said a little slavery is okay, but he was trying to accomplish what he could in the political situation and the legal situation that he found himself within the rules of the Republic, recognizing that if he could just get the ball rolling in the right direction, there would eventually be dramatic change. And in fact, there eventually was dramatic change.
Well, Lincoln had to slow down some folks who were moving way too fast. And on the other side of the slavery question is Duff Green. And Steve, oh, wow. I must compliment you for the photo you provided the readers on Duff Green. He definitely looks like a conspiracy theorist, and he looks like a prophet of sorts. But tell us how Lincoln handled him and the Crittenden Compromise.
You bet. Amazing character. In the photo, he's got a long beard. He's in his 60s, I believe. He's got this long walking stick. He was a ferocious guy. You could imagine him like thwacking you with that walking stick. Right. He was a pro-slavery propagandist. He had been close to numerous presidents going back to Andrew Jackson in the 1820s and 30s. He also battled with almost everybody that he knew. He eventually fell out with Andrew Jackson and went over into the opposition. He was in many ways a terrible guy and an extremist. He also was someone who was himself attacked and beaten and bones broken for things that he wrote in his newspaper, which were awful things, but this sort of made him a hero of the freedom of the press. You know, he'd been attacked just because of his words, and he refused to retract any of them. In fact, he would repeat the things that he was attacked and beaten for. But he was pro-slavery. He was obsessed with slavery and was on the opposite side of the question from Lincoln when Lincoln ran for president in 1860. Lincoln won as an anti-slavery candidate in 1860, and Southern states began making moves to withdraw from the Union. By December of 1860, the first few, in fact, had withdrawn from the Union or claimed that they could withdraw from the Union. And Duff Green thought that he was going to work out a compromise because he was friends with the president-elect. Now, that's the first thing to remember about Abraham Lincoln. He managed to be friends with this guy who held these awful views, but they'd been political allies from time to time on other issues than slavery. And Duff Green went to see him, and Lincoln was happy to see him, and they talked for hours. And Duff Green tried to get Lincoln to sign on to this compromise that had been floated, the Crittenden Compromise that you mentioned, named after a Kentucky senator. And it was complicated, but part of it was agreeing to enshrine slavery in the Constitution forever. And there were things having to do with slavery in the West and other things. And Lincoln was willing to have the conversation, but ultimately did not sign on to support Duff Green and others in their effort to get this compromise through Congress. He felt that if he gave in on some of the provisions there, that the pro-slavery forces would wipe out all the progress that they had just made by winning a presidential election. Ultimately, he wouldn't do it. Ultimately, he insisted also on upholding federal authority as president. Ultimately, the South fired the first shot in the Civil War, and Lincoln was ready to fight them.
That's a great story. We mentioned Seward, William Seward. Such an interesting example of how politics plays out for the better. I got to thinking, Steve, after I read your chapter on Seward, I think if I was there in 1860, gee, I hate to say this, being this old Illinoisan, that I might have been for Seward instead of Lincoln. And I say that because politically, he was considered too much the statesman. He was the guy that took the strong anti-slavery view. In a way, I got to thinking, was Seward the Bernie Sanders of 2020?
Oh, interesting question. Some did find him, I mean, it's a funny way to put it. Some did find him too radical. But you mentioned his experience as a statesman. He also had the kind of experience that should prepare you to be president. He'd been governor of a big state, the state of New York. He'd been a United States senator. He'd been involved in foreign policy. He'd been overseas and seen things and done all these things to prepare. And then the delegates at the Republican convention in 1860 chose this other guy who had been to Congress for a couple of years and was a good public speaker, but didn't have any of that national experience that William Henry Seward had had. And I mean, there are people who regard this as almost miraculous, but in studying American political history, I've realized it's kind of common in a way that American voters go for the person who is relatable and also seems to be the fresh new thing, as opposed to the experienced person who's been around the block. And we can think of presidents in our own lifetime who fit into that category. I mean, I'll give you two. I mean, I'll just name two, one from each party. Barack Obama was said not to be that experienced, but came out of Illinois and won the presidency and excited a lot of people. Donald Trump had no experience in political office whatsoever when he ran for president, and obviously excited enough people to win the presidency in 2016. And this right. is really common. And Lincoln is in that tradition, that he was the interesting guy who actually mm-hmm. benefited from having less of a record. He made him harder to pin down. Seward, in fact, had said some radical things. I don't know that I would say exactly that he was the Bernie. Well, let me think about that for a second. Because I'm now liking this comparison, because Seward would sometimes say radical things, but was ultimately pragmatic. He was possibly even less radical on slavery than Lincoln. He was a pragmatist in the end. Bernie right. Sanders sometimes says radical things, but on a day-to-day basis in the United States Senate has in fact been very practical. And I don't mean to say that I agree or disagree with anything that he's done. I just mean that he's gotten a lot of things sure. done and contributed his vote to a lot of things that were less extreme than his rhetoric might be. Mm-hmm. So there is something to that comparison, I guess.
Well, there were certainly some hard feelings in the Seward camp for what happened regarding Lincoln's nomination. And that's where it gets really fascinating from your standpoint, because you show the reader how Lincoln was able to finesse the competitor, to finesse who was an enemy, but now he needed him yeah. as a friend.
Yeah.
Please tell that
yeah.
story.
Absolutely. And I feel that he did a lot of things well. First, he was willing to reach out to Seward. Lincoln's campaign managers reached out to Thurlow Weed, the guy that we mentioned who was William Henry right. Seward's money man and alter ego and ally. They reached out to Weed. They reached out to Seward. Lincoln met with Seward eventually during the campaign. They sent letters to each other. And there's one letter where Lincoln writes Seward, it's October, the campaign is going well. And Lincoln says, and I'm paraphrasing here, I forget the exact word, but he's using the first person plural. You know, the election is about to fall to us. We are about to win. And so he's including Seward now on his team. He didn't say, I'm about to win. And he, as soon as the election is over, offers Seward the top post in the cabinet, the Secretary of State's job. And Seward was, in some ways, a very difficult person to handle. And this is one of the famous stories, of course, in the book. Doris Kearns Goodwin has told this. Other people have told this story. Many people have told this story over many, many years. Seward could be a very difficult person to handle. But in looking at this, I think that Lincoln also got use out of Seward, got value out of Seward. Seward gave him a bunch of advice for how to edit the first inaugural address. Lincoln then edited the edits to the first inaugural address. Now, his supporters, his partisans will say, this means that Lincoln was the more brilliant guy and that he didn't really need Seward at all. I don't quite see it that way, having been through many edits myself as a writer. Seward was useful in that process and gave Lincoln some ideas that Lincoln then shaped and made his own.
Makes sense. Today I'm speaking with Steve Inskeep. He's the author of the new book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America. The book is a compelling portrait of Abraham Lincoln's political acumen in a country divided and the lessons for our own disorderly present. So I don't think there is a more disheartening bio in your book than the story of Lean Bear. And I think it's well chosen for the way Lincoln meets with the chiefs and what I think you called his futile sales pitch. And then, yeah. of course, the Sand Creek Massacre. I mean, it's just very difficult to imagine that time. Could you yeah. please share that?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this was a hard story to tell, but I felt it was important. And I liked learning about Lean Bear, one of the people I'd never heard of. I was doing some research and came across a photograph from 1863. And it was a photograph of this Cheyenne leader Lean Bear and some other people who'd come on a delegation of Plains leaders, Plains Indian leaders, to the White House to meet Lincoln in 1863. And the caption of this photo said, within a year afterward, three of the four men pictured here were dead. And wow, that caught my attention. And I began looking this up and learning about this encounter. And this was 1863. There had just been a war in Minnesota between a Native nation and white settlers. There was fear of another war in the future state of Colorado, which is where the Cheyenne lived, and there'd been a gold strike that was bringing out white settlers and treaties violated and many things that are familiar to us from many stories in the 1800s and well beyond. And in an effort to maintain the peace, this delegation of Plains Indian leaders was invited to the White House. And Lincoln gave a little speech, which is recorded, newspaper people were present, and Lean Bear was able to give a speech. And Lincoln's hope was that the Indians would cause no trouble, not join the civil war that was going on either side, and also not go to war against white settlers. And Lean Bear essentially gave him a warning. He said, "We're fine, we're good, but the real problem is the white settlers. They're the ones who are causing trouble. They're the ones you need to worry about." And events proved him right. Colorado militia members later killed Lean Bear for no reason that is understood. They did commit the Sand Creek massacre that you mentioned and kill other people who were in that Plains Indian delegation who were trying to be peaceful at the time. And these are really well-documented atrocities. There's not really another side to these atrocities at all, the way that they were investigated.
Right.
And I mean, it's just really, truly awful. But there is a lesson there in that Lincoln, in this case, had invited the wrong people to the meeting. The people he needed to lecture or talk to or make friends with or make allies of was the white settlers, because they were the problem in that circumstance. The Cheyenne leaders were not.
Well, there's one of your biographies that is reminiscent of something I learned during the Trump presidency. And you'll really think I'm going off the rails on this one. But as you know, former Vice President Pence would not meet with a woman alone in his office. And that was a 21st century event. What I did not know until I read your book was that in the 19th century, Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, forbade Lincoln from meeting alone with a woman. So there's precedent for the Pence action.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, this is something that was thought to be true, and it seemed to be out of Mary's own insecurity. And Pence was doing his thing for his own view of morality and religion,
right,
and
right,
affirmatively doing that. So we don't want to make an exact comparison,
yeah,
but it is kind of funny. Lincoln did meet with women. It was said that he felt very awkward around them. He described himself as being awkward around women from time to time. But mm-hmm, there are a number of women who are characters in this book who went to see him at the White House, and one in particular was Jessie Benton Fremont,
right,
the wife of a famous and important general. And she went as an emissary from her husband, John Charles Fremont, to essentially argue with or complain to Lincoln, who wasn't having any of it, but at least took the meeting. And yes, there is a little detail where Lincoln comes through a door and closes the door to meet with Jesse and a man who had escorted her there, by the way. And then someone props open the door again as if they want to listen from the other room.
Mm-hmm.
And one possibility is that was Mrs. Lincoln on the other side of the door, although we don't really know that detail for sure.
Well, let's sum it up or conclude with Mary Todd Lincoln herself. She was quite the president's spouse. I mean, this is a woman who really, from time to time, even after his death, took a life of her own.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that you end with her. This has been, I mean, if any of the chapters in the book are controversial, this has been the most controversial chapter. Why did you write about her that way? Why did you put her at the end? I put her at the end because she does come out on her own in a way at the end. There's this moment at the end of their lives where Lincoln is effectively trying to bring his wife on board for renewing their marriage and trying to be a little more cheerful from now on. They'd had a very difficult marriage, a very difficult war, obviously. They'd lost a son. She had grieved a lot and had very difficult times. But I think that by focusing on Mary after the assassination, if you look closely, you see someone who revealed some character and also illustrated some of the difficulties of being a woman in the 19th century. As I write, she was really interested in politics, was very smart, was a good judge of people, but wasn't allowed to practice politics the way that her husband was. Had to practice it through her husband, if at all, and could not get better at it the way that he was allowed by society to get better at it. When he was killed, she was instantly a nothing. I mean, it's shocking to think about. Like, they lost his salary, which was their only income, instantly. She lost her home because it was the White House and she had to move out right away. She lost everything. And because she was a woman, she couldn't do the things that you could do as a famous person in that circumstance today. Like, she couldn't go sit on corporate boards or get a regular job or do much of anything particularly. And she had this desperate scramble to pay debts that she had run up while she was first lady, certainly unwisely. And she fought for herself through the political process. She fought to get a lifetime pension for herself. It wasn't pretty, but she got that out of Congress. And then her own son had her locked in an insane asylum, and she waged a successful public campaign, as I write, to get out of the asylum, to emancipate herself. And that worked. And she managed to spend the last years of her life in Springfield, living not far from her husband's grave. The Mary Todd Lincoln story is a complicated one, for sure, but she is an interesting character nonetheless.
Well, you did it well. We've run out of time, Steve, but again, I want to thank you for the book, Differ We Must, How Lincoln Succeeded in a Divided America by Steve Inskeep, and remind our listeners that we only touched 3 or 4 of the 16 encounters. The rest are in that book. Take a look. You will really enjoy reading this. Steve, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Great to be with you.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Appreciate it.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.